It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Another storm is brewing between the Wacomico County Council and the county executive, this time over appointments. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Wacomico County Executive Bob Culver has reportedly decided not to send his reappointments of the department heads to the council for approval. It issues a charter amendment that was believed to have required the council's okay, but Culver says as he reads the amendment, it does not. This is just the latest saga in a tense relationship that has flared up over time between Culver and the council. Sort out the legal and political tangle of these latest events, and our studio this morning is Greg Bassett. He is editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, lay out for me the basic issue that Culver has made in terms of his argument that he doesn't have to send these to the council.
So, in the charter that was adopted in 2006, when we created the county executive form of government, the council was allowed to confirm the county executive's appointments for department heads. There are 10 department heads that are part of his cabinet. The charter also said that within 6 months after an election, within 6 months of an election, those appointments had to be reconfirmed by the council. So we just had an election last year. It's 6 months would have been this week that Culver was supposed to resubmit those appointments for consideration. There was gossip out there that the council wanted to get rid of two of the department heads, perhaps the lawyer, Paul Wilbur, and the rumor was the human resources director, Michelle Ennis. Culver did not want the council to interfere with his appointments, so he has declined to send the nominations. Now, what he is citing is a charter amendment that was also approved in this last election that expanded the council's power to also approve deputy department heads. And that opened up a whole can of worms in terms of overseeing those people. The county executive thinks that he should have total control of the assistants of the deputies, that the council shouldn't have any role in this. It's an expansion of the council's role. He was opposed to it at the time. So what he is saying is that the language in the charter amendment that expanded it out to deputies wiped away the language in the original charter. And the council is saying, no, it's just a supplement. It's just an amendment. It's an addition. It doesn't wipe it away.
So when the charter amendment, as it was written in terms of the election issue for deputies, that was intentionally designed, that it was intentionally written not to necessarily include the department head section because they thought that was already covered?
Correct.
Okay, so.
So it's a very complicated thing. But Culver's contention, I think, is probably not true. I think the council's intention was legitimate. Culver's intention is not legitimate based on how I read it and lawyers that I talk to. But he has not followed the spirit of the charter. But the bigger issue here is he sees them as trying to take away his power. There were charter amendments in the midterm elections 2 years ago, which took away some of his powers or gave the council more power. Same thing this last time. Historically, with charter amendments, we have a big charter committee. 20 people meet. They talk about it forever. They vote on it, and then they take it to the council. The council this time, though, in the last two elections where charters were determined, charter amendments were determined, the council kind of did it on their own, like within their own little body. And he sees it as them trying to take his powers away.
Yeah, I guess there's a citing of a 1975 case, Allegheny County, talking about holdover appointments. How does that apply?
It barely applies. That situation up in Allegheny County was about a zoning commission reappointment. It was another political thing where a new regime came in. They wanted to get rid of the people that were on the planning commission, but they were allowed to keep holdover appointments. So Paul Wilbur found that. That's the only Maryland case law that he could find, he said. That kind of applies to this situation, but to me, it's sort of an apples and oranges thing.
So as I read particularly your piece was that Paul Wilbur, who told the council this is what was going on with Culver, seemed embarrassed.
Yeah, that was my word, embarrassed.
Okay, tell me a little bit of why
you said that. He was clearly uncomfortable because he was having to tell the council that he did not support his boss's position on this. Now, the whole county attorney thing is another big mess. One of Culver's campaign promises was to do away with the county attorney's office as designed by the charter because there were several attorneys and it was a very expensive proposition. He's never created that county's attorney's office. He hired Paul Wilbur, to be the county attorney, and I think Paul bills by the hour. Now, Bob Culver will argue that he's saving about $300,000 a year by doing it this way, by not having a legal office. But you've got a lawyer that works essentially for the county executive in the county, who's the county attorney, but he kind of comes and goes. And because of that, the council has gone and hired their own attorney, Robert Taylor, who sits at the table and gives them advice at the meetings, because they don't necessarily trust the executive's attorney on this thing. So you've got two competing attorneys, basically, one for the legislative branch, one for the executive branch. In this case, Paul presented the county executive's arguments, but then under questioning said that he did not support those arguments.
You mentioned, by the way, Taylor and Wilbur, I got here. They were long time names. With Robert Taylor being very critical of this Salisbury City Council, and yes. He's been here. I mean, tell me about these two individuals.
Yeah, they're both very fascinating. Paul Wilbur has a long history of being a government attorney. He's been the town attorney for many local jurisdictions and for zoning boards. He was the town attorney, the city solicitor in Salisbury for a long time. And he advised Barry Tillman when she was mayor. Certainly Mr. Taylor was an opponent, political opponent, as a citizen of Salisbury, of Barry Tillman. And he would go to meetings and he would offer these lawyerly observations about things all the time. I remember one really bad meeting where they ousted a council president and elected someone else, and Mr. Taylor stood up and called it, you know, Salisbury has become a banana republic, and he would, you know, create words for journalists to write down. But he always had an opinion about what was going on in Salisbury, and certainly a lot of those opinions conflicted with what Paul Wilbur was doing as an attorney. So there was a kind of a personal historical thing going on there, and now here they are at the same table, but on the opposite sides of the table.
So what can the council do? I mean, if Culver doesn't send over the appointments?
Yeah, so that was their question. Last Tuesday night, they had the big meeting, and the meeting was taken up by the parents from Mardella who were upset about the capital improvement delay for their school. But then afterward, after the room cleared out, the council continued to meet, and Mr. Taylor gave the council some advice. That was the question. What do we do now? It seems like it's headed to a court of law for a judge to decide somehow. Most people don't want to do that because it's going to be an expensive legal process. The county's going to have to spend money to defend this and to prosecute this. But Mr. Taylor suggested, and I thought it was rather bizarre, that perhaps security could, if the council could go ahead and assume that the people that are in the office now are the people that the county executive would reappoint, and therefore they could vote on these people. And if the council did not approve them to continue, then they could be removed from office. And the question was, well, how do we, you know, remove them from office? Do we lock them out of the building? Do we escort them to their car? There was no.
Sounds very familiar, but go
it
ahead.
It sounded like a police state thing to me, but there wasn't really a result there. I know if I was a department head and the council voted to fire me, but my boss wants to keep me, I can't wait to go to court and sue for that. I mean, that would be a real mess, I think, in terms of a human resources issue and an employment issue. So I think they're sort of stuck right now. I think it's going to head to a court. Now, one of the things I need to report on this week is, do they really go through a court process, or do they do some mediation? Do they get a retired judge to come in and hear both sides and make a ruling? Can they agree on who this would be? And then the other complexity is that because Mr. Wilbur is involved as a reappointment, he cannot be involved in this. He's got a conflict. So he cannot represent the county. The county will have to hire an outside attorney, which the council has to approve because they appropriate the money to make all this happen.
Was there also a suggestion that maybe just not to pay these department heads?
Yeah, that was one issue. That's one way that the council could block the payment. It would be a misappropriation of funds to pay someone that we had not authorized to be in that position.
Although they don't write the checks.
They don't write the checks, but they authorize the funding. They could cut that budget.
Hmm. So as I indicated, this is sort of this longstanding tension between the Culver and the council. What is the story with that? I mean, certainly from the beginning there was conflict, but even in the last election when he was up for re-election, I talked to people, leadership people, who were dissatisfied with Culver's leadership, and that included people who were Republicans, people who may have sided, say, with John Cannon, the president of the council. What's going on in that dynamic?
Yeah, that's the other thing. They're all Republicans, which is interesting. So there's not a partisan issue here. Now, the council does have three Democrats on it, but they mostly sit silent through these things and kind of watch the Republicans kind of eat at each other. So I don't see a party issue being there. But basically, it's just a matter of who's in charge. You know, Bob feels like he's driving the boat. The way I've described it is the council wants to be in the front seat with him, and they want to hold the map and point out directions and let him drive. That's fine, but they're going to decide where we're going. And it's just that constant legislative, executive branch tension that you see all the time. But Bob wants to protect his power and have the ability to do things his way. And the council wants to hold him in check, but also do things their way. So it's kind of elbows under the basket, I guess is one of the analogies.
How does that contrast with his predecessor, Rick Pollitt?
Rick was a little bit different. I think Rick wasn't as hands-on in terms of things. But Rick certainly had his issues with the council. He had a Democratic council for a long time. It was very partisan. Republicans took over. They sniped at Rick a lot. He didn't always take the bait on that stuff. But he also had much more of a bureaucracy in terms of he had like two deputies and he let them really run things. You know, this is nothing against Rick, but I felt like he was more ceremonial. You know, he cut ribbons and he was the ambassador for the county. But Bob's really in there making really, you know, minor decisions, very, very detailed decisions about what goes on. He's very, very involved in everything.
Now, the two people that you indicate that might not be reappointed, what's their story and what does the council necessarily have against them?
Well, with Wilbur, it's interesting. The whole county attorney system bugs them that Bob's not following the way the charter intended it for it to be. But I think what happens with these lawyer guys is they do a lot of their work is in the closed door meeting. So you don't see that because it's personal issues, it's property acquisition stuff. So there's things that go on in those meetings where there might be tensions and they feel like they get bad advice or just no rapport, things that I can't quite figure out. I remember there was a thing about an expense issue with development down off Riverside Drive where some contractors were in. Paul was supposed to review some invoices for expenses. He told them he had. Then Bob Taylor announced that he had gone through and he had reviewed them and he found some stuff. So there was like some tension about that. Like maybe Paul had misled them. I think it was just a miscommunication. The thing with the HR director goes back to this from very early in Bob's term, of the first really ugly encounter that these two groups had with each other, where Bob had authorized a raise for Ms. Ennis. It was discovered in an audit of the county. The auditor said, "We don't know what happened here, but someone needs to look at it. Someone needs to ask some questions." And Bob was offended that they would ask questions. You know, it's up to him to make these raises. He's allowed to do this. He controls those budgets. They authorize the money, but he controls what happens underneath the big picture of the spending. And there was an ugly back and forth with some lawyers and some auditors. And I think that also caused some trouble. And when you think about it, too, the HR director in any organization is never the most popular person because they instill the discipline.
Right.
They fire people. So the employees aren't necessarily lined up to love the HR director.
So where do you see this going in terms of his relationship with the council over the next 3 years or so? I mean, in one sense, and sort of an observation of mine, but in the last election, Culver kind of skated out a bit in the sense that the Democratic vote, whatever that happened to be, got split off to an independent, and then there was an independent candidate, and then, of course, it was Culver, so that Culver is able to actually win re-election. What is it? How do you see this going forward politically then?
I think Bob's safe for as long as he wants the job. I think the county, things are going pretty well. He did an amazing thing this year where he agreed to fund the school board budget for the first time ever completely, $800,000. On the back end of that, now he's getting beaten up because in order to fund that, they've delayed a renovation of the Mardella School that's in the capital plan. It's different money, but it's all money. One of the things that has been reported that I'm working on this week is he's also put off the sheriff's office for a year. That was another political promise that was very popular with people. But where it's going in terms of all this stuff, well, in terms of his election, I think he's fine. But the council members say to me that when they're out in the public, people just go, "Why can't you get along with Bob? You know, what's going on?" And Bob says when he's out, people are like, "What's going on with you and the council?" They don't really understand it. They just know there's something weird going on there. But it really is just the branches of government, each exercising their own power and maybe not respecting each other the way that they could or should.
So are you optimistic this is going to get resolved one way or the other? Or is it going to be an expensive resolution?
I think it'll be an expensive resolution.
Yeah.
There's nothing to indicate right now that either side is going to back down. I did get a letter overnight. I was leaked a letter where Paul Wilbur, the attorney, sent a letter yesterday to the county council or to the county executive, saying that some council members had approached him and urged him to resign, but he wasn't going to resign because if he were to do so now, the county would have no legal representation and it would leave the county vulnerable. So he will stay in office until a reappointment is made. He doesn't really say whether he wants a reappointment from some if someone else to take his job or not. So I've got some reporting to do on that. So that's developing. But I think they're going to have to go to a court thing and let the court say that not necessarily that the county executive is breaking the charter, but he's not complying with the charter.
By the way, assuming we talked about the Democrats for a moment, what are they doing in all of this? Do they have a particular position, or what are they saying?
I think the only one that I've heard say anything so far is Bill McCain, and he was a council leader when he was on the council before. He occasionally says stuff, but Ernie Davis and Josh Hastings haven't really said anything on this issue.
And by the way, Mark Kilmer, he's leaving, is he not?
He is. He's returning to his native Idaho, and Mark is essential. He's he's kind of the key figure in all of this because Mark is a charter guy. He loves the charter, and he's been the proponent for many of these charter changes throughout. And he's just come in, and he worked in Washington, D.C. for a long time on Capitol Hill. He's very much into that process. He's come in. He's asked questions about why does the charter say this and why does it say that, and council members have complained that they would like this power, that power, and Mark's like, we can fix the charter and give ourselves that power. So a lot of these charter changes have been driven by him. He's been the point man. He's the person who explains the charter changes to people like me and the public. So his departure, I think, will change things. Maybe the charter won't change as much because there's not someone who knows how to manipulate those gears. But he's been a good councilman. He's going to be a missing piece.
So, by the way, we mentioned a moment ago, Martella.
Yes.
Seemed to explode in the face of everybody, particularly Culver, who did not seem to anticipate this happening.
He didn't get out in front of it like he really needed to, which is a shame. So what happens with these capital budgets? If you look at the capital budgets, they're 5 years out, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff on the wish list. Once Beaver Run, which we all thought Beaver Run, which is getting rebuilt next year, we all thought that was going to be a big fight. It ended up not being a fight. And then the next thing on the list was the renovation of Mardella. So the school board building commission went through all the processes. They met with everyone in Mardella. They considered three plans. One was to close the school and build it somewhere else. The other was to tear the school down and build a new school on the same site or next door. The third option was to renovate the existing school. The public wanted that school to be renovated. So they went ahead and put in the capital budget that that's what we'll do. Well, with all the stuff that's coming down the pike with minimum wage increase, it's going to cost the county $7 million because they have to adjust everyone's salary. We've got the Kerwin Commission, which is out there, that's going to ask that more money be appropriated for education in different areas. There's thought that there's going to be a recession probably a year from now or like a year from this November when it would probably hit. And they're still smarting from the last recession because it was just so brutal for the county. With all those considerations, they said maybe we don't want to spend all this money right now. We want to hold off. This is all borrowed money, but it's money that they have to make payments on, certainly. So they said, you know, Mardella's gone 60 years with the school, and there hasn't been a renovation there since like 1980 or 82. Every year that school wins an award from the comptroller's office, his Silver Hammer Award, because they're able to keep a failing facility going so well. The maintenance people just do a great job out there. There's a lot of pride. But anyway, people got this idea they were going to get this new school. It's been put off a year, and they were very upset. Now, this happens all the time with projects. Like I said, the sheriff's office has been put off a year, but you haven't heard about that yet. If the sheriff makes a stink about it, then you'll hear about it. But I think maybe he understands what's going on, and he'll still get it. He'll just get it a year from now. But this happens all the time, but these people really thought that it was coming. They were going to get it, and now they're not, at least not for another year.
I mean, do you get any sense why you've got such a turnout? I mean, of people showing up for this particular project as opposed to, say, other projects outside of, say, for instance, the sheriff's office, which is sort of a singular thing. But
when you go to the Mardella High School in middle and high school, there's a sense of pride that's there that is not like in any other school. It's a small school. It's a small community. It's a tight community. They all talk to each other. They're very they feel like the Salisbury schools get all the attention and they're kind of forgotten. There's maybe a little chip on the shoulder kind of thing going on. They're a high performing school because they're small and there's, a lot of attention given by the teachers, which is a great thing. And they're just very proud. I mean, an example of their pride is oh, no, you can't tear down the school and build a new one. You need to fix the one that we attended all those years, because they want that memory. They want that continuation of who they are. It's a very prideful area.
You have any idea how many students they got?
I forget what it is. Yeah. I should know that.
That's all right.
But it's a really small number. It's like 600, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So at one point, I think I read that Culver just simply said, well, maybe what you really need is a new school.
He did. I was wondering if he had been paying attention to what had happened in all those hearings, because that was not what they wanted. But, you know, from his point of view, and I get that, financially, in terms of the environment, there's a failing septic system out there. The ground is not great for that septic thing. Really, you should tear that school down and build a new one. And I was also recalled the fight in Pittsville in the 70s when they closed the Pittsville High School and moved everyone to Parkside. That was really the right thing to do, but that community is still angry that they closed their high school, you know, 40, 50 years later, whatever it's been now. It was 1977 or 6. They're still upset about that, and I know it would be the same thing in Mardella. I mean, you see this argument in Somerset County all the time, where their cost per student is so high because they have so much infrastructure, because they have all these neighborhood schools. And, you know, really in Somerset, they should close Crisfield School and send everyone to school in Princess Anne. That would make sense financially, but as a community, no one wants to do that. And it's the same thing with Mardella. I mean, in terms of pure dollars and cents, close Mardella, let them go to school at Bennett and Parkside and Wye High. Those schools could absorb that population, but that community is proud of its school and wants to keep it.
So as I understand it, Culver suggested that maybe there might be some money then for the roof, something like that. He's going to negotiate something like that?
Yeah, they need a new roof at Westside, so he's going to put that off a year, put some of that money. That's the proposal right now, and I know they're meeting about that this week, and I need to do more reporting on it. Take some of that money and throw that in to help get things started in Mardella. It's not going to, you know, anything that starts now, it still takes 5 or 6 years. The kids that are there now are not going to benefit from this. It's kids that are at the middle school level or elementary that might benefit later. But yeah, that's the idea, that he might be able to advance the ball somewhat that way and take some of the heat off.
So how does this, in a minute left or so, how does this contrast to how the city of Salisbury is operating? When I first got here, it was Salisbury City Council and mayor would seem to be dysfunctional. The county seemed to be running fairly smoothly, and now it seems like we have this reversal.
I think in Salisbury, what you have a battle of ideas. You always had a battle of ideas before. Everyone thought different things about the future of the city and what should happen. Now there's just one idea. The guy with the idea in the room is Jake Day, and he makes a proposal for something, and people sit there and they go, yeah, that makes sense. I don't know how to argue with that vision because, okay, yeah, okay, you know, and even if they don't agree, they love the enthusiasm and that he's going to try stuff. You know, he has the guts to try all these things that I would, you know, there's a list, like, we're going to build an amphitheater. I'm like, that's dumb. Well, it's beautiful. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing. The traffic circle that they're about to build on Carroll Street, you know, it's like, that's not going to work. But, well, the idea is things can't get any worse. Let's just try it. You know, and when he talks like that, it's really easy to rally around him. There's a lot of sincerity, and he's got all the best ideas in the room. And I think I'm not in his pocket that way. I just see that. That's how people react to him. Where at the county level, they're still like, no, I think we should do this. And no, I think the hearing the other night, Mardella, someone made some comment about the Salisbury schools getting all the money that they're favored by the county and all this stuff. And people applauded because they feel like that people care more about Salisbury than they do Mardella. Is that true or not? You know, I don't think it's true, but that's certainly the attitude, and people rallied around that.
We've been speaking with Greg Bassett. He's editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent, a large piece, by the way. I think it was in last week's paper, but you can pick it up online. Very detailed. In some ways, when you read about how people weren't sending up people to be appointed and so on and so forth, I thought I was reading about Washington, D.C.
Well, it's one of those issues. I can't tell, you know, it's a boring thing, but so if you kind of overwrite it, maybe people will read it.
Maybe. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. It's called The Seven Rivers, a novel about a black family in a small waterfront town. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The novel follows seven teenagers in a town along the Severn River outside of Annapolis. And the Sweetstones, an African-American family who live amidst a racially diverse community. It takes place in the late 1970s, early 80s, and revolves around the trials and tribulations of their daughter, Sherry. We have the author in the studio this morning, Cynthia Hammer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what inspired you to write this particular story about this young girl growing up? In many ways, that will seem very honest in terms of the kinds of things that she encountered.
Well, it's a depiction of my life growing up. When I was 9 years old, an African-American writer, Miss Betty Baker, was my mentor, you know, and I wouldn't know that she would be my mentor until like 30 years later. I don't want to age myself. So I picked up a book from the library, you know, my first assignment. I pick up a book and it's called What is Black? And I read it so many times and it was about everything that is black, that is beautiful. And I screamed, oh my God, oh my God. And my mother's like, what's wrong? Be quiet. Stop, you know, making all that noise. I said, the author is black. She's black. And I could not believe that someone finally had related to me. And so fast forward, I pray that I meet her one day. And the long of the short is that I did. And I told her a story about my younger brother falling through the Frozen Seven River, and which was a true story. And I saved his life at 12. He was 10. And she said, that's a book. Call it Iceberg. You need to write about it. And, you know, fast forward, the Iceberg did very well. And I wrote a sequel. And that's how I birthed the Seven Rivers. And the Seven Rivers is now the seven teenagers going into from middle school, journeying into high school. And it's a story about, you know, bullying. I was heavily bullied as a child to the point where I became a bully out of survival. You beat them, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. And, you know, we grew up in a time where we did tussle on the playground and you really didn't go home and tell your mother. You just fought it out. You might have shook hands afterwards. It wasn't to the point where you felt like killing someone or, you know, taking someone's life. We actually valued life. It didn't even come into your mind. However, you did go home with the emotional scars of being an outcast or, you know, just the confusion of the day seemed overwhelming. Maybe I don't want to live another day. Just all the things that, you know, children, you feel as a child emotionally as you're growing up, as you're trying to grow and navigate your way through your teenage years. So I write a lovely story about friendship, betrayal, making the right decisions, implementing God, because I believe for me, if it wasn't for God, I would not be here. Like he was my saving grace as a child. So that's the inspiration behind the story, is me just being able to tell my story.
How much of it is autobiographical then?
Probably 99.9.
These things really happen, huh?
Yeah, yes, it's actually, yeah, there's a lot of truth to it. I do exaggerate a little in the haunted house. The haunted house story is true. For those who love mystery adventures, the haunted house story is a story I heard as a child when my grandmother was living. And my grandmother and my dad and my mom worked on a property that was very close to our home. It was like if you cut through about a mile and a half through the woods. There was a huge mansion that sat on a hill, and it was haunted. And I won't give it away.
Right.
But I believe, I do believe.
as we often do, right? Well, you open the novel, actually a few chapters in, about this party on the beach with Sherry's friend Cara. You seem to be setting up all these relationships. Tell me a little bit about that party and how those characters relate.
Okay. So what I liked about literature growing up is that I always liked, I'm a huge Shakespeare fan and I love Macbeth. I love the way the author sets up the reader to understand that art will unfold. If it's good, if it's written well, if you read it again, almost like the Bible, if you read it again and again and again, it opens up to more than it was the first time you read it. So when I write, I try to make it so that it has meaning and then it'll have meaning again and again. So the chapter's called The Hustle. And the hustle to me is a young girl who has this huge birthday party and she tries to position herself to be the, she's the new kid at school, but she positions herself to be the most popular. And the hustle is that she's already a spoiled child who has everything, but she's a very manipulative child. And so she invites the whole class, the fifth grade class, to a birthday party and excludes the competition. So then I put in, and then she gets all these, she gets the an array of gifts, like the driveway lines up and the cars are stopping and they're coming with bags of this, you know, and that. She has all these beautiful gift bags coming to her. And what she doesn't realize, what Sherry realizes through the years and in that moment, that the young girl really doesn't care for any of them. And that was truth. I did have a really close friend who was my saving grace. It was only because of her friendship that I was not harmed. I finally was no longer bullied when she befriended me. And I didn't have a problem being her friend in all of the trials and tribulations of being her friend, because it's a high price to pay for the friendship. But I was willing to risk the high price so I would not, so I'd no longer be bullied. So I was, and I did everything I wasn't supposed to do, and I was okay with that because it was better then. And I think a lot of kids can relate to that. So, but the hustle, you know, the music comes on, because back then they had the Disco Inferno, and the hottest dance was the hustle.
Right.
So I can recall as the child that we bonded over the hustle, the literal song of the hustle. And when everyone lined up at the slumber party to dance, I couldn't dance, so not all Black people can dance. So I could not dance, and neither could she. And that was our bond, that we fumbled in that moment of vulnerability and also bonded and stepped away from the party and really bonded, and that birthed our friendship. But when I call the chapter The Hustle, it's really the young person at that young age knew how to move people across the board. I think kids can be very manipulative if they're not guided properly. And the thing about this, the main character was neglected. So she kind of navigated her own way as an adult and got to do whatever she wanted to do. And her decisions wasn't always the best. And I followed greatly along because my parents were very strict. And at her house, it wasn't as strict. And I got to see how other people live. Like, you know, take for instance, like a doorbell. Like, we didn't have a doorbell. We had a screen door that flapped half the time it was off, half the time it was on. But when I rang her doorbell and you could hear the, you know, that beautiful sound, I was like, it opened a whole nother world. And so I tried to show each teenager, without giving the reader like too much, you want to allow a person to use their imagination, but through a series of circumstances, you get to understand their emotional and mental and just their physical and just their mindset, and I want the reader to relate to it. I try not to guide the reader with my perspective. I use a series of circumstances because we all have a different perspective.
Right.
And so that is the purpose of the Seven Rivers. And a lot of people have gravitated to that, even adults, because it takes you back to a time when, you know, it was fun to play outdoors and you actually played outside. You know, we actually have, you know, creek jumping, rock throwing, as boring as it sounds, it was fun. It was amazing because you were bonding and we weren't on our cell phones. And I'm not knocking the cell phone era, but we've raised our children on a cell phone. And for me, I believe the understanding of what I know today comes from the ability to run and play outside. You know, I think many, many people relate to being outdoors.
There's also a character, in some ways, I think symbolizes the, sort of the white community around her, which is Carl. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about him. And he, I mean, on the one hand, he certainly befriends her, but on the other hand, she comes to realize in the end, of course, that he actually despises her.
Yes. And I never really, you know, it wasn't until I wrote the story that I said, darn, there was a lot of underlying, there's a lot of things that I stuffed to survive. And I believe that the time to tell the story was just the time to tell it. And I was trying to write about how awesome my childhood was. But as I was writing, I thought, wow, this stuff happened. Let me just put it on paper and see what comes to the surface. And Carl we were the best of friends growing up. And so I write the loveliness, but I was a tomboy. I was very small and I was very fast and I was very good at sports. The only reason I didn't excel at sports is my parents couldn't afford to drive me back and forth. You know, if I could walk to get there, my brother did. He walked to his basketball practices. And when the neighborhood people who were taking their kids saw him, he would hitch a ride to his high school. He went on to play for the Harlem Globetrotters. What I'm saying is he was willing to walk. Right. My parents was not taking that 25-mile drive. And so, because they were working. So I can't put it on them. But so I did not pursue. I was very good in a lot of sports, but I didn't pursue that. So what I'm saying is I was very athletic. And he was not. And he was to an extent, but he wasn't like I was overly athletic because I had four brothers. And so there was some resentment there and jealousy, which I did not realize because I beat him at everything. But that was just the era. If you practice long enough, if you swim against the kids that I swam against in who swam like fish, like they were very, very athletic. I was the worst of them. But for to be around people that are make you better, I would be the best to the average. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just how it was. And he was just not.
Not there.
No. And that was okay. But it bothered him, obviously. So I found myself that day trapped on that cliff. And I don't want to give it away.
Sure.
And it really opened my eyes. It terrified me, but it opened my eyes. And it hurt as well. And we didn't speak for the longest time. And also, growing up in that era, people always questioned, well, why are you friends with her? Or why are you friends with him? That was the parents in the children's ear asking, why are you friends with a black person? You know, always questioning. And they always defended with, oh, you don't know them. Or, you know, if you play with them, you're this and that, you're in trouble. And so sometimes your friendship would just end without knowing it. And then you were friends again on the kickball field. And then it would end again. And then pretty soon the kid would make their own decisions and they didn't care. And they would. It was a constantly convincing their parents that this family was okay. And eventually, obviously, somebody convinced some way it worked out, mm-hmm. that we weren't a threat, and it shouldn't have been even an issue. But you know the era, and it's unfortunate because it's not that far 70s and 80s. You know, you'd think we'd had come a little further. Anyway, so Carl was under pressure as well to not have an African American friend because his mother was trying to be friends with someone that was very popular in the neighborhood. So he has to put that kind of pressure on the kid. So I write it in a story, and it was good that you caught that, actually.
Well, you talk about that. There's a quote or from the book talking about Sherry was too black for white kids and too white for black kids, tired of being picked on. It's like she's walking along this edge in which she doesn't belong in either one. I mean, obviously, maybe she does. I don't know.
Yeah. I tell you, just hearing you say that, I'm so grateful to God because when I wrote Iceberg, I really had to pause for a minute and say, wow, we survived all that. When my brother, I get a little misty because there was a lot of, this is not a story about bashing white people or being a victim, there was a lot of white people that jumped in front of us. I get a little misty.
All right.
Because in the era we're living in now, we're so separate and divided. But there were a lot of people that took up for us. A lot. And I can remember a story that a young white... I didn't think I was going to get misty. Excuse me.
It's all right. Go ahead.
Pull it together. Because you know what I'm saying? Not everyone's racist. Let's just come out and say it. So anyway, there was a lot of people that did that for us. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that. So could you remind me of the question again?
Sure. So she was walking this line.
Because on the
one hand, two black for the white community and two white for the black community.
Yes, yes. So... okay, so every day I think every day riding my school bus, we were picked on until I got to high school. Until I got on, and the only reason I got on the bus, another bus, was my mother was saying that it was unsafe for us to ride with the other neighborhood school bus. And I finally got to ride the bus with the kids I played with all summer. But that was only because we had endured so much that it was a fight that it was ugly and it was bloody and it was cruel. But they threw me off the bus because I fought. I was tired, and I fought like my life depended on it. And they finally got the message that it wasn't safe for my brother and I to ride the school bus anymore because my older brothers. Had moved on, and it was just me and my younger brother. So then I get to high school, and all of my white friends that speak to me, the black people see that, and they didn't like it. So I was bullied by black kids for knowing white kids. So pretty much I hated high school, I have to say. I did. I hated it. And I have to say, on my tears, because I really think it's about these kids go through so much. And when I think back, I was like, wow, I'm still here. And the tears are for, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Now I'm writing about it. So basically, I'm getting the last laugh. But art does imitate life. And the depth of the fact that God carried me through all that, I hadn't realized how in depth that kind of... it's a form of abuse that you have to endure just to go to school and get an education. And that's why I wrote the books, because kids are going through this just to go to school. And it's your God-given right to get an education. And it's not my problem or other kids' problem that the parents aren't raising their children. It's not. You know, if a kid has to abuse another kid just to feel okay about himself, something is wrong. And yes, it's the parent's fault. It's not the teacher's job, but that's a whole nother.
Right.
That's a whole nother show, right?
Well, let me ask you this, because it turned to the parents, because one of the scenes, I imagine this actually, if I were seeing it on film, and I don't think it would come across as much. You talk about Red and the father and beating Maurice for some transgression, right?
Right.
And he said, and you write this, that evening Red had unleashed all of his pain from childhood to adult failures, hate, and anything he lacked, he poured into Maurice.
Yeah.
It's and it reminds me, in fact, of a number of African-American characters I've read and seen. What about that? It's as if he's all this pent up frustration then suddenly is unleashed on Maurice, who's not responsible for it at all.
Yes. Well, and let's be clear, it's not just an African-American dad. It can be a white dad.
Right.
It can be a Hispanic dad. It can be a Japanese dad. You know, a lot of times our parents grew up very rough. You know, my dad had a lot of kids by the time he was 26. So I get why he went through his difficulties, because that's a lot to take on with the world already against you. And as an African-American man, he couldn't speak up to his boss because he needed that income and he had mouths to feed. And I'm not saying it was right, but he had his own reasons, his own issues, like many of my the kids that I grew up with, we all heard each other's stories, and it's for them. It's their story. It's still their story to tell. But it was no different. They, you know, I think in that era, there was you kept a lot of things in. And so, but what I did understand that day from knowing my father's story, that he had a rough childhood. And it just seemed like it never was about his kids. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that day, it was just... it was horrific. And Maurice, my brother says to this day that he deliberately fell. So he would, you know, like he was like dead. So he would stop. And so that's what he did. And so, but the pain from that brings into well wishes to run away. It
right.
rolls into that. So I would say this, that I just believe that there's no excuse for... okay, it's no excuse to still blame your parent for how they parented you, because as an adult, you have a choice. And there's no excuse for a parent to say that we did the best we could. You did what you wanted to do. Now, some people look at it different, but I believe my parents did what they wanted to do. And I don't hold any resentment against them. They're lovely and wonderful people, but I break the cycle with the choices that I make. And so what I say in the book, I hope people get, I don't say it like that. I say it through circumstances that we have our own choices. And I was talking to a friend last night that still have issues with their parents. You make your own choices. We can no longer blame someone. My mother made me do this, or my dad made me. You're 40.
Right.
You know, so in that situation, I think that there's a lot of frustration, but that takes us in. I'm not one of those, I believe in the black fight, but I'm not one of those people that stand out politically, because I do it in a different way. And what I believe, and I believe in all people, I just don't believe in, because I'm African American, that I have to stand with all black causes. Right. I stand with the cause that I believe in. So when you ask me about the African American father, I can only answer that I believe anyone can have issues that they unresolved that'll resonate into their everyday life.
Her mother, Sadie, mm-hmm. It's a slightly different approach. You quote her saying that all of her children were creative and smart. She was so proud of them, often boasting to her clients about their grades, shattering the illusion of what whites thought black children could accomplish. Some were jealous, thinking their children should be doing better. After all, they had more than the sweet stones, or at least they thought so. Much different feel to the mother there.
Yes, yes, yes. My mother did raise us. She worked as a housekeeper. Now that in itself, I didn't realize that till I wrote my first novel, that I had to go and to work and clean with her to the kids I went to school with. How embarrassing is that as a kid? Now, I went on to realize that I got my first house out of writing a letter to the bank on why I would be a great homeowner, and it brought them to tears. So that's a whole nother story.
Right.
But what I was trying to say, I have a work ethic because it started when I was a kid. So what my mother did was she taught me a trade at a teenager. I had my own business when I was like 16. She taught me a trade, but I didn't want to be like my mom. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, parents will take you into what they know, and you could always feel something else calling you. So my mom she's very humble, and she was a helper. She didn't mind helping you. She was very humble, but she was not educated as far as having many options. But people loved her, and she would take the shirt off of her back. And my dad would, too, as well. I mean, they both are moral people. They believe that you pay your bills on time. I don't pay anything late. My dad would say, if you don't pay the electric bill on time, the police will come. So my bills were late, I'd be looking out the door. That's how naive I was. So I didn't mean to stop. Excuse me. So I pay my bills on time. So they did some things right. So, but my mom was, she punished you, but she didn't punish you like publicly. She would pull you aside, and she didn't have to tell you twice. But she could do that with love. But her threat was, I'm going to tell your father. Well, that's all we needed to hear. Yeah.
and she has a pride in her children.
Yes.
I mean, that's almost a pushback from the expectations and the world, the white world outside.
Yes, yes. And you know, she loved all of the kids that I mentioned. She read them like a book. She knew their pain. After all, she worked in some of their households. So she knew their pain. Now, she didn't share that with me. I didn't know their pain until we got to be teenagers and we were talking about it. But she saw from behind the scenes. So she always had a special love for each one of them. They loved seeing her, and she treated them like they were her son or daughter. And I believe now is because she knew what they were enduring. And but she raised us that, you know, we're no better than anyone, and nobody's better than us. And it made it a lot easier. You know, there were times when I didn't realize the diversity. You know, I don't know if it was the denial or the fun or the love. I'm going to lean more on the denial.
I don't think we, as children, I don't think we realize what the world looks like around us, what it is. I mean, I can remember thinking back that in Kentucky in 1954, I went to school. Well, the odds are I went to a segregated school, but as a child, I didn't know what was going on, right? Right. Isn't that how we are?
Yeah, I believe the innocence is what is your survival tool. Exactly. You're really not focused on that. I mean, you can feel that something's not right. I could go into a room and feel something is not right and not put my finger on it. And that underlying pull on your security can bring into insecurity and bring you the need to be approved of. Because no one said to me, there was a few teachers, but no one said to me, that a girl, go get him. I had to build my own muscle and carry my own cleats. And I'm not saying that as a victim. I've overcome that. But I realized in my writing that that gave voice. I was painfully shy as a child. Sometimes I stuttered. I would hide. If you walked in the room, I would hide. You know, I did. Well, not today.
Not today,
Not today.
Right.
But I had to overcome those things. And that was because of no one told me my value as a kid. No one did. I mean, there was a few teachers that really paid attention, but when you have a class of 30, when you feel neglected and abused, you need to be stroked a lot to right. healing. And they didn't have it, but they didn't insult you. But they didn't have the time, I guess you could say, to give that constant focus to just one child that was needed. But they did. I like a lot of my teachers. Some were horrifying, and but I understand today that it's important for a kid to know their value. And I'm not a big fan of a kid having a birthday party and everyone should get a gift. No, it's that child's day, and you need to raise your kid to know that it's their child's day and it's not about you. But that's another show, right?
Well, let me ask you this. So we won't give away the ending of the book, but I'm curious about, does Sherry eventually outgrow, and what you at least perceive down the future in terms of her future, does she outgrow the kind of bully that she's become, or is there a hint at the end? I mean, where is she at that moment that we kind of leave her?
Yeah, I don't want to give it away. So I would say that she has some tough decisions,
right?
And she chooses the right thing. Hmm. She chooses the right thing, and sometimes the right thing can be painful, and it can leave you alone for a moment. Because with kids, it feels like the right thing could be an eternity. And what if this happens? And what if that happens? But you have to always lean to good. Good always outweighs evil. It wins every time.
So you envision her as overcoming this, what she's become in high school as a bully.
Yes. Yeah, I do. And I navigate to how and why.
Right.
I don't leave the young reader or the adult reader without an understanding of that we all go through difficult times, but we do come out on the other side. And you have to go through. Part of life is going through. See, the crushing, I call it being crushed. You know, God will crush you in areas to grow you. And I was saying the other night, quoting the Bible, the tare and the wheat. When you come up, the wheat, it doesn't come up without the tare. So all that pain and agony, as a child, is a purpose. But it doesn't feel like it. And the only thing that kept me going was I always thought that I would be somebody. And whatever that somebody is, but I always felt it. And I always felt that God was saying, come on, you can do it. And I'd be like, God, just take me now. You know, because it was too much to bear. And so if I felt that way, I can only imagine what these young kids are going through. And so, you know, I really feel for them. I have a lot of empathy for the kids. And I don't say this to think that it's going to be any easier, but I do believe that everyone has a purpose. That's true. Everyone has a purpose. And if you can make, I'm not saying that all the things that come in your life should, that's horrifying should, because a lot of times people come in your life that shouldn't be there and they harm you and they shouldn't have. It's just a key to how you survive it, how you make it through.
Before we wrap up, you set this in a very small town in Maryland, I guess it is. Tell me a little bit about this small town that you have this events occurring and why that small town?
Okay, so it's not, well, today it's not so small. I left out the name of the town because it's outside of Annapolis, and it's along the Seven River. And there's many towns along the Seven River. But the Seven River, I put the Seven River because it's the seven teenagers, how they intertwine and right. their rivers and their life, the ebbs and flow of their mental and emotional state. So the town that I grew up in was small, and but living on the waterfront, it gave you an array of adventures, you know, and I leave that out because I want the reader to picture their own town. Because a lot of people say to me, well, this reminds me of how I grew up. You know, the sign that says no trespassing is the very place we wanted to go. And, you know, we were chased off of properties and we outran the dogs. I write this awesome tale of in my first novel and a little bit in my second of the, you know, we all have our pets, our lovely, friendly pets. And we always have that street that you want to hear that chain. You hear that chain, you pick up an extra speed, you know, because he's right. crossing yards and he's on your trail. So a lot of people can relate to the small town living. And so I leave it out deliberately and I changed it, you know.
Right.
For the people who, a lot of people are very happy about a lot, but I always also want the reader to imagine how they grew up. So this small town outside of Annapolis is a lovely place to live. And I think, well, Maryland is absolutely beautiful. So a shout out to Maryland. Maryland is beautiful. I think it's one of the top 10 places to live, for sure.
You now what live in California.
I do live in
Los
California.
Angeles. Los Angeles.
I do. I live in Los Angeles. And we're with the Lost Angels. And I do have a summer place in Ocean City. So I get my come back and get my stability and my blue crab.
There you go. Well, we've been speaking with Cynthia Hammer. She's an author of a novel, The Seven Rivers, about seven teenagers in a town along the Severn River outside of Annapolis, I guess finding their way, as it were. I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.
Without a doubt, Says You is the toughest quiz show on the air. And one of the funniest forms of recreational thinking.
A neoplasm is a new growth about which we may want to be concerned. And a pleonasm...
It's a sneeze you don't cover.
Yes.
Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous with quotable bon mots, Says You.
Saturdays at 10 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Rock and roll didn't happen overnight. It had been building up steam ever since World War II. And in the early 1950s, it was called rhythm and blues. But you couldn't hear those jumping sounds on the jukebox in the front. You had to go to the juke in the back. I'm Matt the Cat. Join me each week for an in-depth listen to the soul that came before rock and roll on the juke in the back.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.